Thank you. Be seated.
The court is ready to hear argument. Second case, 271 in Re Lee Bass.
Good morning. I am Robert Grable of the Fort Worth Law Firm of Kelly Hart and Coleman, and represent Lee M. Bass, Lee M. Bass Inc. and Palladium Corporation, who I will refer to collectively as the Bass defendants. Brenda Clayton, an associate in my Austin office, is also here on behalf of the relators today. The ultimate issue in this case is whether the trial court abused its discretion in ordering the Bass defendants and Exxon to produce 3D seismic data and defendants' proprietary interpretations of that data, covering a portion of Bass's La Paloma Ranch called the ERP Tract, which covers some 20,000 acres of the 30,000-plus acre ranch, plus a one-mile halo around that acreage for a total of over 30,000 acres of seismic data. Both Bass defendants made proper trade secret objections to plaintiff's discovery request and filed withholding statements asserting trade secret privilege and proved the trade secret nature of the data at the hearing on plaintiff's motion to compel. We contend that plaintiffs did not prove that the data was necessary to the proof of any claim in plaintiff's live pleading at the time of the hearing.
Mr. Graber, let me ask you, presuming this were trade secrets, yes, the trial court then must weigh the need for the information against the harm by its being revealed, correct?
Yes.
And that would be a fairly broad discretionary piece of the analysis.
Yes, if you get there. Right?
If you get there.
Yes.
But how do we get there without disposing of the merits of the claim?
Well, we're not saying that the court needs to dispose of the merits nor even view the merits like the old plea of privilege practice. We are saying, however, that in answering the first prong of the continental power test, has the plaintiff proved that the trade secret data is necessary for a fair adjudication of the claim, that the plaintiff must first allege a claim. It must allege a culpable claim. So look at the pleading. Does it allege a claim recognized in common law in Texas?
Which is my question. If there's any authority out there that there might be a claim or if the authority is conflicting, how can the trial court abuse its discretion by allowing this discovery? Well, first of all, would you agree?
If you get to the necessity prong, but we say under these pleadings and under these facts, there is not even an allegation of a claim, that any fair reading in the broadest possible sense, giving all possible ambiguities to the claim.
But if it did state a claim,
yes,
and if it were a claim that is arguably recognized, even if we haven't addressed it substantively, then would you say the trial court abused its discretion?
In this case.
How? Assuming alleged, assuming arguably a claim, how can we then say the trial court abused its discretion in balancing need?
Well, in this particular order, he abused his discretion clearly with respect to the interpretive work. Now, that part of the case, that part has gone out because the plaintiff withdrew it. But, I mean, the court...
But in terms of what we're here for today...
In terms of what we're here for today, if this court believes that the plaintiff's petition states a claim recognized at law in this state... And that this
or arguably recognized.
Or arguably, or a fair extension or whatever that part of the bad faith. Then we get to the issue of whether or not they prove this is necessary for a proof of a claim. That's getting fairly far down the track. I did, at the hearing on the motion to compel, I did go in with the witness about weren't you the very same witness for other plaintiffs sitting on this ranch? Didn't you do a study? All of this information goes to damages only. None of this information we're seeking goes to liability.
I understand. I guess what I missed in the briefing was, are there other means that you claim are available to obtain the same information?
Yes. Well, not the same information, but information from which they could prove a damage case.
And what evidence is that?
Pardon?
What evidence is that?
What evidence is that?
Well, there are other ways.
In the previous case, the Hoover case, and this is getting fairly deeply into the record of the hearing, but up until the last 10 or 15 years there hasn't been any 3D. 3D seismic is a fairly recent phenomenon, I guess, exploration and technology, and the industry has for centuries, 20th century at least, found most of the oil that's ever been found in this study by surface geology, subsurface geology, and other means. And for the purpose of putting on a damage case, you know, what damages do we think arise from whatever breach of this, what I view as a non-existent claim. They could prove a damage case without proving seismic. They did it in the attempt to do it in the Cooper case. There was an immediate precedent on the very same land.
Well, what about liability? I mean, there's no liability here unless they can prove their recoverable reserves, right?
I would disagree with that. I don't think the amount of oil and gas that might be recovered if there is drilling has anything to do with liability.
If there were none there.
Eventually, they're alleging this, in our view, non-existent duty to develop on the part of a mineral owner, 100% of the minerals. We don't believe that duty exists. We believe it affirmatively does not exist. But if you get into the cases on implied duties, the implied covenant of reasonable development under oil and gas leases as opposed to conveyances, the plaintiff's burden is to prove what a reasonable prudent operator would do in the same circumstances, which has in it proof that a well could be drilled and a reasonable profit made, which gets into the geology and what a well is.
So again, my question goes back to, if there arguably is a claim out there, how can we say the trial court abused its discretion?
Well, it's a closer question. I think he still
Which then gets me back to my original question, is really to rule your way, we have to dispose of the merits of the claim. We have to say there is no such claim.
Justice O'Neill, I don't believe you have to dispose of the merits. I think you have to look at the pleadings and see, does this pleading fairly allege a claim recognized at law? If the answer to that is no, we never reach the factual merit. I mean, is there a merit? We're just looking at pleadings. It's not that different than what happens on a motion to transfer venue. I mean, those are decided on pleadings and affidavits. This, in my view, should be decided on pleadings, affidavits, and implied proof.
Well, but the issue is it relevant to a claim that's alleged? You're arguing that they've alleged a claim, but this claim is not recognized in law, and therefore it's not discoverable. Don't we have to conclude that the claim is not recognized as a matter of law before we can say it's not discoverable, and what we're effectively saying is it's not relevant. It's relevant, but not to a claim that's recognized in law.
We say that, but we say more than that. And let me, if I may, to clear this up, let me tell you how plaintiff's counsel characterized their claims at the motion to compel. First, in direct question, and this is from page 45 of the transcript of the hearing, direct question of their expert. Plaintiff's counsel says, Mr. Brown, that's their expert, if my claims in this case are for damages for Mr. Bass's failure to develop the La Paloma acreage and or discouraging Exxon from exercising their option to lease, can you provide me with testimony that evaluates my damages? Okay. Now, so he claims, if my claims are failure to develop and discouraging Exxon from exercising their option, can you give me damage evidence without the 3D seismic? Now, when you go to his closing, he says, and this is argument to the court, after we've argued, look at their Fourth Amendment pleading. There are no claims in there that touch the earth acreage. All of it goes to this weekly acreage, which involves this 1982 partition and some complicated provisions of that deed. In his closing argument to the court, Mr. Brass says, they said, referring to counsel for Bass and Exxon, that we haven't pled enough to make this data relevant, and that's just false. We have a pleading for breach of fiduciary duty. Fiduciary duty. Very clearly, the most latest, our amended petition, which I think is the fourth, we state that Mr. Bass, on the IRC property, on the La Paloma property, has discouraged production and development. Then we get to the causes of action. We plead breach of fiduciary duty. It's been pled. It is relevant. But if you look at their pleading, the breach of fiduciary duty, paragraph 24, says plaintiffs would show that Exxon and defendants Liam Bass and et cetera, as co-tenants of the mineral estate under the former Wheatley property, or alternatively, as co-tenants of the executive rights concerning tracts A and B, which by definition are all the two tracts of the Wheatley property, owed the plaintiffs fiduciary duties and breached those duties and thereby harmed the plaintiffs in an amount greatly in excess of minimum jurisdiction court. His own pleading expressly limits the fiduciary duty claim to the Wheatley property. It does not touch the IRC property. You can read this pleading from now until dark, and you will not find anything in here that implicates the IRC property, except two sentences in the factual allegations that allege a non-existing duty to develop. Now, So our primary position is it simply isn't alleged that a plaintiff first, in order to discover trade secrets, you've got to plead it.
So your real objection is this evidence is not relevant.
Yes. There's no. He hasn't reached the basic scope of discovery that it's not relevant to a claim expressed in his last pleading. We say beyond that, in trade secrets, under the Continental Tire test, you have to prove not only that it's relevant, but also that it's necessary for the fair adjudication of the claim. We say he didn't get over the first hurdle, and we say, moreover, if you want to port your paragraph 21, which is a factual allegation, the only part of the pleading that talks about IRC at all, and that says plaintiffs also own royalty interests under portions of the La Paloma Ranch, excluding the Wheatley property, and that's the IRC property, which was included in the geophysical lease option, etc. Upon information and belief, Bass unlawfully prevented or discouraged the proper and reasonable exploration, development, and or production of mineral reserves under such property to plaintiff's detriment. Now, if that asserts a claim, it's not a claim recognized in Texas law. And so we're saying that the trial court, in applying Rule 507 in this court's opinion in Continental Tire, must at least look at the pleading and examine it. Does it assert a claim? And not upon proper objection by the person owning the trade secret, that if he asserts that the claim pled was something like, you know, I don't like blonde-haired, blue-eyed women, and therefore I've suffered emotional distress, that's not a claim.
I mean,
that's a silly example, but we say legally that that's no less a claim and no more of a claim than what's pled here.
Putting aside the fact about blonde-haired, blue-eyed women for the moment, let me ask you this. One of some of the evidence you introduced on trade secret status was that this information is only shared within the industry through confidentiality agreements. It's protected by confidentiality agreements.
I don't believe that was part of our proof. We have proof that it's frequently done that way, and this particular agreement between Bass and Exxon had a mutual confidentiality agreement until the Exxon lease option expired, after which each of them were joint owners.
And taking that one step further, if Exxon were to share this with anyone, it would only be through a confidentiality agreement, correct?
Yes, most of the time, but I don't believe and our brief touches on this, that an express confidentiality agreement is necessary to maintain the trade secret character of the data.
Well, but
it typically is done.
It shows that you do try to protect it.
Yes.
That's a typical in the industry. Right. Why is this any different?
Why is this any different?
Because they'd be getting it subject to a confidentiality agreement. So why should this be any different?
Two answers to that. First, again, we believe that it's an abuse of discretion under Rule 507 in the Continental Tire opinion to jump to the balancing test and give a protective order, which is clearly what Judge Pinellas did, before you look at has plaintiffs proved that the trade secret is necessary to prove the claim. You don't get to balancing until he's proven
necessary. Well, you balance need versus harm.
Correct. But if need is not proved, as I read your opinion in Continental, you don't get to the balancing test.
But if any need is proved, even a minimal need, then, well, let me ask you this. Is there any way in which you claim the confidentiality agreement in this case is insufficient to protect the information?
Yes, we do. We make proof, at the hearing to say that if the court, our position hearing was, at most they're entitled to is a Wheatley data. They're barely entitled to that. But over there, as opposed to the IRC, where these plaintiffs own only very small fractional non-participating royalty interest in Mr. Bassman's 100% on the Wheatley, they own the full one-third of the minerals. He has the executive rights over that in our construction of the deed. So there, we represented the court that if the production order was limited to the Wheatley and a strong protective order, underlying strong, we wanted the data at a neutral third-party consultant, where it could not be loaded on a computer hooked up to the internet, where it's one mouse click away from the world, and a lot of other complicated provisions, with all of which were not included in the protective order we got. And we think the protective order issue is insufficient. We are concerned of the leakage of this data
But that's not been raised substantively here, has it? I mean, you haven't attacked the inability of the protective order to protect information.
Let me ask you a question. This trade secret notion, you're arguing that it's trade secret, and I'm not sure I'm convinced it's a trade secret. It seems to me the only reason this is just information that somebody goes out and scientifically produces this information. The only value it is to your client is the ability to sell it on the market, it seems to me. The ability to solicit people who will drill or to get an interest in the minerals or something. The only value to this is you actually share it with somebody else. So it's not like the Coca-Cola formula, that only Coca-Cola wants it, and it's only to be used to produce Coca-Cola. It looks to me like it's a marketing deal, and the only reason you don't want it to be known generally is because you then lose the economic value of being able to sell it in exchange for getting somebody to do something on your property. Is that really how? If Continental Tire sold its formula for making tires on the market, I could see that it would argue, wait a minute, don't release this to the public because then it loses its economic value. But it seems to me they'd have less of an argument so long as whoever it was leased to was under an obligation they could not release it to the public so that the market value was still protected.
Well, Justice Enoch, a couple answers to that one question. One, its worth is more than its ability to be sold. It can be used. Leon Bass Inc. is one of the Bass companies that is actively engaged in oil and gas interest, in oil and gas business itself. Leon Bass Inc. participates in wells through Bevco and the Bass family. So in the first instance, it can be used for self-development of the earth property by Mr. Bass.
But he owns the property, so nobody else can develop it based on his information.
True, but it has value, and I believe one of the three points that I intended to cover in my opening presentation today was the nature of a trade secret. What is the test, legal test of a trade secret? This court hadn't addressed that issue since 1958, and should the court move to restatement of unfair competition third, section 39, which has a very succinct definition of a trade secret as any information that can be used in the operation of a business or other enterprise and that is sufficiently valuable and secret to afford an actual or potential economic advantage over others. And then comment D expounds and says a trade secret can consist of a compilation of data or other form of economically valued information, which is precisely what seismic data is. Seismic data is the cornerstone, the most important cornerstone of oil and gas exploration. If it's not a trade secret, it is big news to the oil and gas industry. And the interpretations of seismic data are the ultra secrets of the oil and gas industry. Those are the most secret of all data of oil and gas companies. So if this sort of information is not protected as trade secrets, I submit it as a big surprise to the oil and gas industry because they go to great lengths and go, read the testimony I put on through our geophysicists at the motion to compel hearing. This is kept in a locked, super secret
vault. Don't you ordinarily look at a trade secret as being something that you don't want anybody else to know so that you maintain some sort of competitive advantage? But
yes,
the value to seismic data is the ability to sell it on the market, to actually share it with somebody else.
Or use it. Mr. Bass can use this to develop his ranch. He drills oil wells. He's drilled oil wells on several of his ranches. He owns this property. He can drill it himself. You know, Liam Bass Inc. and other Bass companies under the umbrella of BEPCO, and this again is proved in the hearing, are one of the most active and largest independent producers of oil and gas in the state.
But he owns the property, so nobody else can use that data in competition with him on his property.
But an oil and gas lease is a defeasible fee transfer. Oil companies who don't own ranches, like BEPCO and Mr. Bass, own thousands of other leases, and during the terms of those leases, they own those minerals to the same extent as he owns owns this ranch, all of those leases have other burdens and implied obligations, and that we get off into whether or not there's a duty to develop, and it's a big difference between leases and deeds in that context.
Is it true in the lease agreement that although you're intending to keep the data secret, that Exxon or Bass, without prior notice to the other, can release the data?
At this time. It was not the case until Exxon's exclusive lease option expired. Exxon shot this data. There was a term exclusive option. If they exercised, it remained mutually confidential. If they did not exercise, then each party retained the data themselves. But Justice Jefferson, that's no different than if somebody owned it exclusively. Let's say Mr. Bass shot this data himself. He would have no confidentiality agreement with someone else. If you own property exclusively, you may do with it as you want. You can publish it in the New York Times, you can put it on the internet, or you can keep it secret. And so the fact that two companies own data concurrently and both elect to keep it secret, they don't have to promise each other to keep it secret to maintain the trade secret data. If either of them subsequently makes it public, it would be lawful now, and it would lose its character, but so long as they don't, it remains a trade secret.
Counsel, I think we're advised the light has burned out there.
Well, I thought that was
a long five minutes. Let me ask you just briefly.
I didn't touch it, did
you? Yes, we had a fellow put his hand over you got this information from Exxon.
That's correct. We got it in cooperation with Exxon.
Yes, and neither you nor Exxon has shared it with anybody to this point.
We have not. We don't know what Exxon has done, but it has not been made public. But there are essentially two kinds of seismic data. There's proprietary data, which this is. There's trade data, which a seismic company shoots, and any oil company can come in and lease it and go to input, output, and say, you got any data in Kennedy County? And they'll say, we got this, this, and this, and you can, for a fee, you can get it. This is proprietary data only by Exxon and Bass. We don't know, frankly, what they've done with it, but they haven't done anything that has caused it to become public.
If they had, how widely would they have to share it before it ceased to become a trade secret? Or you, for that matter?
Well, that, I think, would present a fact issue. Judge Hecht, and I think some sharing might be, one peak. Typically what happens, if you want to interest another company, we've developed a prospect, come look at our prospect, see if you want to participate in it. Here's our data, go look at it. If it's done in a manner that keeps it confidential, the fact that you would show it a number of times to others, I think it's still a trade secret. I think until it actually becomes in the public domain, somehow it can be a trade secret, but I do think that would present a fact issue on other facts, not present in this case, is how much sharing has occurred and how much is too much.
I understand your argument. This is kind of a negative value. In other words, if you shot this and this was the hottest oil and gas prospect in America, it wouldn't matter if you shared it because you own it. If you shoot it and it turns out it's a loser, then your ability to market it depends on this staying relatively secret.
Well, we think it has both positive and negative value. There is authority.
What's the harm if it turns out good? What's the harm in it being shared?
Well, I'm sorry. What's the harm if it's shared?
If it shows this is a campus property.
Right.
And you own the mineral rights, where's your trade secret value?
I suppose that this turns out to be the greatest prospect in the world that's made public, and we still have 100% control of it. It's harder to say that we're harmed. I still think we have a proprietary interest in the secrecy of our data. There is no one right answer frequently to interpretation of seismic data. There is a broad range of opinion, and so while I would agree with you that it's would be harder for us perhaps to make a case for damages if it were disclosed and it was, a jury of 12 geophysicists would always say this is a Class A project that might be harder to show harm. I still think we could show some harm. I'm having a hard time telling you exactly how it would be, but it is a matter of general practice in the industry that companies do not put on the street their first-class prospects.
Any other questions?
If you had moved for summary judgment that there was no duty here owed to these world interest owners.
We have so moved.
Well, and it was denied.
No, it has not. Well, it's sitting.
Okay. If it were denied,
yes,
you could not bring it here for us to review the merits of it.
We cannot appeal the denial of the summary judgment. Yes.
And aren't you asking us to do really the same thing here through mandamus?
No. We are asking you for a very limited look under very limited circumstances. Rule 507 does not apply to that much evidence. And we are asking only that the court exercise enough time, patience, and discretion to read the pleading, see if it states a claim. If it does not state a claim to which it's the least relevant, it should not be granted. Now, that's no different than a typical discovery dispute. You know, there are discovery disputes all the time that don't involve trade secrets. This is discovery dispute enhanced, though, because it's trade secret. And so even if it's relevant, then you get to the next question of necessity. And we are suggesting that it's not too much to ask, but even if a pleading states a claim on the face of it, the court at least should take a look. If the party owning the trade secret argues, the court ought to take a look and see if that is a real claim or a fanciful claim. Is it a fairy tale or a real claim? Because trade secrets should not be forcibly disclosed without at least a real claim pled.
So we would be deciding the merits of the claim.
I don't believe you wouldn't be touching the factual merits. You would be looking at whether or not that is a claim, and that's special exception type stuff. Not.
But if we decide that issue, if we say this is not discoverable because they have not stated a claim, isn't that the end of that claim?
It's the end of that claim as expressed in that pleading.
We say there's no duty. There's no other way it could be expressed in the plea.
I agree with that as well.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel. Porter's ready to hear argument.
I will say for every time.
From the real parties in interest.
May it please the Court, Mr. Roger Ball, present argument for the real parties.
May it please the Court. My name is Roger Ball, and I represent the real parties in interest, Scott McGill Jr. and Kathleen McGill Inyard in this case. I don't know if the court knows, but I've recently changed law firms. My current law firm is Seeker, White, and Brawl. Also, in co-counsel of the case sitting on the table is Jane Brawl, who happens to be my sister. So I'll move right into it. I think there is a temptation in a case like this on everybody's part, including my own, to assume that something that sounds so technical and important to the oil and gas industry is automatically a trade secret in every case. I don't think we can do that. I don't think it's fair to do that, and I don't think it's right to do it. We have to look at each trade secret case and every case that comes up on mandamus with respect to the evidence that was actually presented to the trial judge. Judge Bonyalis had a motion to compel with several attachments. He had a response, two responses, with an affidavit apiece, and he had some live testimony from two witnesses at a hearing. And all that stack of information amounts to this. The briefs are very long and detailed in this case. There have been documents added to briefs to further explain people's positions. And so I think when we look at the standard of review and a discovery mandamus, even when it involves a trade secret like this, it's important to focus on exactly what Judge Bonyalis saw. It's also important to focus on exactly what the status of the case was. And in this particular case, plaintiff's Fourth Amendment petition, for example, had been on file for quite some time. No special exceptions were filed. That happened after the motion to compel hearing. Special exceptions were granted. A Fifth Amendment petition was submitted. The actual order that this court is sitting in judgment over today on mandamus is an order that was signed and entered after the Fifth Amendment petition. So, you know, on the one hand, obviously Judge Bonyalis made the decision that this seismic data was discoverable when the Fourth Amendment petition was on file. On the other hand, technically and legally, the order appealed from is an order that was signed after the Fifth Amendment petition and after certain deficiencies or alleged deficiencies were pointed out to the plaintiffs. In all fairness, that's the way it's supposed to happen.
What does the Fourth Amendment petition allege?
Fourth Amendment petition alleges, and this may be at fault in the way that I plead. It starts out with factual recitations and allegations of fact. Then it moves into causes of action. And it pleads, I'd have to count them, Judge, but it pleads about 14 or 15 different causes of action.
And you say all of those apply to this property?
No, Your Honor. Certain of them, the way they were phrased in the Fourth Amendment petition, specifically referenced the Weekly property, for example, which is different than the property we're dealing today. One of them, for example, though, civil conspiracy does not. Defendants, that's paragraph number 29. Defendants Lee Bass, Liam Bass, Inc., Palladium Corporation, and Exxon Corporation agreed and conspired to commit fraud, breaches of fiduciary duties, trespass, conversion, and to otherwise devalue and disregard plaintiffs' executive mineral and royalty rights. Under the evidence that Judge Bunyalis has, for example, plaintiffs don't own a royalty interest under the Weekly property. They only own royalty interest under the ARC property, which is at issue in this case. Was there a cause of action pled against the ARC property? Absolutely. It's to the point...
It's kind of hard to show that if this were trade secret information, it would be kind of difficult to show that its production were necessary to proving that claim. That's what you have to show, right, under Continental?
Well, I do have to show that I have a need for it if it, in fact, is a trade secret which plaintiffs, real parties in interest don't concede.
But you have to show, I understand that, but if it were, you'd have to show that it's more than relevant.
Absolutely.
How would you do it with respect to that claim?
Sure. The actual evidence that was submitted to Judge Bunyalis is as follows. We have Mr. Bass's own hired expert who issues a report, for example, that says, I know Mr. Tim Brown, plaintiff's expert. I know he previously did work on the La Paloma Ranch and the ARC property, and his methodology was flawed. His results were inaccurate, and the truth of the matter is La Paloma has limited oil and gas potential. Once Mr. Bass gives me access to the seismic data, I intend to prove all that's true. That's Mr. Bass's own expert.
That there is limited potential in the ARC property?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so how does this help you?
Well, if I get the seismic data and my expert looks at it, he can make an analysis of the data. He can make reserve calculations. Our engineers can come up with numbers that show, in fact, that's false. There are not limited potentials on the ARC property. So not only is the reliability of my expert's work being challenged, which gives me a need for the data to prove that, in fact, he's right, but also the amount of my damages and what I may have lost over the last 3 or 4 years when Mr. Bass or his companies were failing or discouraging production and exploration of this property.
All presuming there's a duty owed to the plaintiffs here.
All presuming there is at least some type of duty owed, yes, Your Honor.
So shouldn't we reach that duty question first, because it would be dispositive of the discovery issue?
The reason you shouldn't reach that duty question first is because, as discussed in our brief, you really shouldn't get to the merits of the case in a discovery mandate for many reasons. One of which the record was not developed enough, I don't think, for this judge or for the trial judge in this case to decide at that point. The summary judgment was not filed and certainly wasn't heard until after the motion to compel.
But how would determination of whether there's a duty depend upon record development?
The question is, did Judge Bunyalis clearly abuse his discretion in granting this discovery in this mandamus proceeding? And so how can we say, Judge Bunyalis, we never even asked you to look at this, but by the way, you were wrong, and maybe you should have looked at it, even though the defense counsel didn't point this issue out to you, with by way of briefing, by way of summary judgments. That's my answer on one part. If we do look at the duty issue, at least in some limited context, personally, I don't think you can avoid, if you decide to look at the duty issue when determining relevance, I don't think this court can avoid saying, you know what, we're going to grant a summary judgment.
What if you brought a negligent infliction of emotional distress crime and you asked for a whole lot of discovery? Wouldn't we be within our bounds to say there is no such cause of action and you are entitled to any discovery?
I think in that particular case, first of all, I should probably be sanctioned and have my pleading struck from the beginning because the law is absolutely clear on that point. If for some reason the trial judge refused to do it, the Court of Appeals refused to take action in the case all the way to you. I think that would certainly bear on the plaintiff's need for the data.
But if we thought that Danziger satisfied this question or took care of this question, wouldn't that be the same scenario?
I think that, that it could be, but I think it's different. On the one hand, the Supreme Court, with respect to negligent infliction of emotional distress, has been very clear. The Danziger case doesn't even address our situation. So I think that the premise of the hypothetical is flawed in that Danziger doesn't address that. The truth in Danziger is that plaintiffs sold an oil company all of their mineral interests. The oil company agreed to pay them $50,000 and $50,000 over time through production to compensate them for that sale. The plaintiffs in that case reserved an overriding royalty interest, which is kind of like a piece of land man gets if the land man puts together an oil and gas deal. And so in that case, the court held there wasn't a fiduciary duty owed by that reservation of an overriding royalty interest. That case is nothing like this case. That's in essence a land man suing an oil company over how good a job they did developing a prospect. Here we have a mineral owner, an executive rights owner, who has complete control over the financial value of the royalty interest, the non-participating royalty interest held by many other people in this family. So it's not just these two plaintiffs, it's actually others. That's a different case than Danziger. Maybe if there was a Supreme Court case directly on point that said this claim is absolutely frivolous, it has been dismissed time and time again, the law is clear, then maybe you could sit today in this case and say, we're not going to allow discovery on that until you get a summary judgment granted against you.
Continental.
And you get the law changed.
Continental has two problems. One is the person resisting discovery has to show that it's trade secret. So let's say he does that. Everybody agrees, he shows it's a trade secret. Then the second prong under Continental is that the other person the person seeking the discovery has to show that he really does need this, not just relevant, it's necessary to the proving of his case. Now, if all he has to do to meet that requirement is say, Judge, I've got a cause of action that nobody has ever said doesn't exist, and I'm telling you it's necessary, and that's it, there's not much to the second prong of Continental.
Well, that's not the case. That's not the case in this case. I've cited to the court at a minimum of 11 cases in Texas. Well, one of them is actually the Court of Claims applying Texas law, which says a mineral executive owner does owe some duty, whether it be fiduciary duty, duty of utmost good faith and fair dealing, or reasonable landowner duty, to his non-participating interest owners, be they mineral co-tenants or royalties.
Can you prove damages without this 3D seismic?
I cannot prove it reliably, I don't believe. I think that's more of a Robinson question when it comes down. If my expert has to make projections, there's an entire field called game theory, and I think one of them is called the casino theory, where you take old 2D seismic data and you talk about lost opportunities.
Do you have 2D seismic?
I don't have 2D seismic that could be purchased.
Does your expert have it?
He had it in a previous case. I don't know if he still has it. I have not obtained
it. Did he get it in this case?
I believe there are some 2D seismic lines across this 20,000 acres that may be available for purchase. I don't know the extent of them.
And I'd understand that opposing counsel's expert is relying on this data to attack your damages?
Opposing counsel's expert says that my expert, who has previously conducted an evaluation in a different case on the same property without the benefit of 3D seismic data, Bass's expert says, number one, Mr. Brown was wrong in his previous. Number two, his opinions were unreliable and not based upon reliable information. Number three, I intend to prove it by using Bass's 3D seismic data that he will give me. And number four, I, Bass's expert, need to look at the 3D seismic data in this case to do my own job for Bass. So that was one of the reasons we needed the data. There are many others. We can't quantify the amount of reserves that are there. And this is not just a damage.
He hasn't looked at it yet, but he's going to.
I'm sorry?
He's going to look at the data, but he hasn't yet.
That's what he says in his expert report. I assume that if Bass wants to keep this data confidential, he can't show it to his expert because he knows then it becomes discoverable.
I mean, once this happens, then you get it.
That's true, but the point is, when we're sitting there and judged by the Allison's court in the 105th, this is the evidence that's presented to him. Bass's own expert, and tends to rely on the data to refute plaintiff's previous expert's previous work and to do his future work in the case.
So this may be a moot point, this whole issue.
No.
Once Bass's expert looks at it.
Well, I can assure you that Mr. Grable wouldn't do that. It could be a moot point.
So you don't need to make the argument to us since it's not there.
Well, I'd have to defer to Mr. Grable's plans and intentions in his litigation strategy because I don't know what they are. But
it won't be used as a sword against you.
I think that the rules are abundantly clear that you can't both use something against somebody and then withhold it from the discovery. And that was an issue we talked about with the interpretations, which are no longer an issue. One of the questions that was asked by the panel of Mr. Grable was, isn't this really just a damages issue? Is there really any liability component to it? And the answer to that is absolutely. There is a liability component to this. The allegations that plaintiffs made, and in all fairness, this was Judge Bagnales was also the judge in the previous case that we talked about where my expert had done some work. But one of the allegations in the case was that Mr. Bass, or Lee M. Bass, more properly, had actually paid a certain sum of money to an oil company to get them off their lease on their property. Okay? So he bought them off of their lease. And that's what a previous lawsuit called the Hoover and McMillan litigation was about. In our particular case, we allege the same thing, that Lee M. Bass, Inc. has attempted to discourage production and development on this particular piece of property for whatever reason, be it because it's his ranch and he loves it, or because he wants it to look like a nature preserve, or because he doesn't want the pollution that may be associated with production. That's our allegation. And we do have some evidence of that we've discovered by other means. So the question becomes, in proving my case, how can I show to the jury that the reason there hasn't been leasing, the reason there hasn't been exploration, the reason there hasn't been production is not because there are limited prospects, but rather because Lee M. Bass Inc. doesn't want oil and gas drilling.
But don't we first need to know whether that's his call? Don't we first need to know whether a 1.38% or a 2.76% non-participating royalty interest can compel the mineral owner to develop the minerals? I mean, it seems to me that before we did a whole lot of work on the case, discovered even just routine documents versus trade secret information, you would want to know the answer to that question.
Several answers to the question. First of all, the 1.38, 2.76 was not in the record before Judge Bagnales. Number one, that was added in this court for the first time.
Well, your brief says it's right.
Well, it is. But the point is, if we're judging Judge Bagnales' conduct and whether he clearly abused his discretion...
Well, regardless of the percentage, you claimed a royalty interest.
Sure, absolutely. And we claim that royalty interest is very valuable. To say it's a 1.38 interest... 7 years ago, 8 years ago, when production was better out there, that 1.38 interest could mean $40,000 a month. Could mean hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. So it's a significant interest.
Well, I'm just saying, however much money it may be worth, and whether it's two or four or three, or whatever it was the same in Judge Bagnales' court as it is here, and you admit that that's what it is. And my question is, wouldn't it be good to know whether that interest can compel development of the property before we went to a lot of trouble to discover documents and put on damage?
I still have three responses to
Great.
That question. Number one, we never get to that question respectfully if they have not proved that this is a trade secret. But the evidence was very scant on the subject matter of trade secret. If it's not a trade secret, then we look at Walker v. Packer and we say, okay, the judge didn't wrongfully compel privilege information. Question number two, is the discovery patently irrelevant to any claim and, not or, but and, would it be unduly burdensome to require production? Okay? You can't meet the second prong of Packer by any means by delivering a three-dimensional magnetic seismic tape, a little 16-millimeter tape about this big. Press a button on a computer, it's delivered. Not unduly burdensome. So if there is no trade secret, you don't get there. That's answer number one. Answer number two. If these plaintiffs do not have any cause of action against Mr. Bass or his company for activities on the Earth property, is the data still relevant to any of the parties' case? And it absolutely is. Plaintiffs presented evidence at the hearing that on the Earp property, you have the what's called the McGill field. It's an old field up there. It's been producing for a long time. There's a lot of well data. Okay, so we can look down these well bores, we can get the data, and we can relate the three-dimensional size of the data with that well bore data to actually determine which structures are oil and gas bearing, which structures are prospective, which structures are not prospective. And so if my claims are limited to the Wheatley property, which has very limited well control data, I still need to get out to the west, to the Earp tract, where there is a significant field, and there's a lot of data available in the public realm about this well. And I need to proceed, as Mr. Brown says, from the known area on the Earp to the unknown area on the Wheatley. And so by doing that, that's really the only way that we can make his opinions reliable. So the data is not just relevant to Earp, it's also relevant to Wheatley.
And three?
Your Honor?
And three?
And three. I might have talked myself out of three.
Might I say that three is what we're reviewing is the trial court's discretion?
Yeah, what you are reviewing is the trial court's discretion. And when we look at these cases, there are cases saying a duty is owed. There are cases saying a duty is owed. And when Judge Banyalos issues an order compelling production of data that is relevant.
Well, I have two questions. One relates to liability and the other is the damages. Let's suppose my grandfather deeds me a 1/16 royalty interest in the family ranch. Can I then sue my grandfather if he decides to turn it into a game preserve and doesn't want to drill ever out there during his lifetime?
Yes, you could. Yes, you could.
And my second question is, let's assume that the property next door was owned by someone that was unrelated to this lawsuit. Can you go and compel them to produce their 3D seismic under a protective order?
Well, I think discovery on non-parties like that is an entirely different animal that's governed by a different rule of procedure. I would have to show the need, obviously.
And three?
Your Honor?
And three?
And three. I might have talked myself out of three.
Might I say that three is what we're reviewing is the trial court's discretion?
Yeah, what you are reviewing is the trial court's discretion. And when we look at these cases, there are cases saying a duty is owed. There are cases saying a duty is owed. And when Judge Banyalos issues an order compelling production of data that is relevant.
Well, I have two questions. One relates to liability and the other is the damages. Let's suppose my grandfather deeds me a 1/16 royalty interest in the family ranch. Can I then sue my grandfather if he decides to turn it into a game preserve and doesn't want to drill ever out there during his lifetime?
Yes, you could. Yes, you could.
And my second question is, let's assume that the property next door was owned by someone that was unrelated to this lawsuit. Can you go and compel them to produce their 3D seismic under a protective order?
Well, I think discovery on non-parties like that is an entirely different animal that's governed by a different rule of procedure. I would have to show the need, obviously. And if I can show the need and we balance the risk of harm versus the benefit or my need for the data, and that balance comes out in my favor, the answer is yes.
If this is a trade secret, can you prove your damages as the Wheatley property without the 3D seismic?
I think that's a question that remains to be determined when we have a Robinson or have no adult.
Wasn't that your burden to present evidence on that at the hearing? Isn't that part of what you had to show?
Part of what I had to show is my need for the data, yes.
Right.
Now,
right.
It's
availability
showing
from
that
another
it's
source.
I'm sorry.
Availability from another source. Did you have to show that it was not available from another source?
Well, to the extent I did, that has been proved. Both Exxon and Bass put on evidence and testimony that they are the only two who own this data. And apparently my time has expired. There's one other thing I'd like to point out to the court with the court's permission.
Any of them have a question? Thank you, counsel. Your time is expired.
Thank you.
I know I probably used
You have 5 minutes remaining.
Thank you.
Mr. Grable, the question was asked of Mr. Braw, wouldn't it be, before we get all involved in all this discovery, wouldn't it be appropriate to find out if there is even a cause of action here? And so I guess I ask you that question. There are mechanisms for asking the court to address whether or not there's cause of actions existing. Would it be, is it appropriate to address, to put the court in a position of addressing that simply in the context of a discovery dispute as opposed to a motion for summary judgment or a motion, you know, the plea to the jurisdiction or any other sort of dilatory plea?
We had filed a motion for summary judgment. It has been submitted. It has sat undecided for over a year.
Did you ask the court to stop discovery until you determine the threshold question of cause of action?
No. But we had this. In fact, the summary judgment argument occurred after the mandamus was already filed at the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals.
In the trial court, did you raise this legal no duty issue in the motion to compel?
Yes. Clearly, that was.
What about your expert? Is your expert going to rely on the 3D data?
No, unless it's compelled to be produced, and we have not. You know, that issue is.
What was the evidence at the hearing about what your witness say about the 3D data?
Well, my expert, Mr. Hilty's letter says, basically, if and when, but he hasn't done a study yet. If and when he gets the data, you know, he'll do the study. But at the time, we have not submitted the data to our testifying expert. Mr. Braun knows that. I don't believe he said. I've listened closely. I don't think he accuses of that. But in fact, we have a Rule 11 agreement that we will not do so. We will not use the interpretations. And I know that if I give it to my testifying expert, I might as well give it to him.
You know, it presents a tricky situation at trial, you'd admit, when the experts get on the stand, because to the extent you're going to be attacking the reliability of their data, you know, if you say, well, you can't tell from this information whether that's true, or you can't tell from that information, and you start tearing it down on that basis, knowing there is data that you could tell that from, doesn't that create a bit of a problem in terms of necessity?
It creates a dilemma or a decision for the owner of the trade secret. Do I wish to, you know, make it more widely available because I've been sued, or do I want it? Is it so valuable that I would rather protect
it? But I guess what I'm asking is, when you take their expert witness on cross-examination, it strikes me that if you start attacking the underlying premise of some of their conclusions, knowing that you have the information that would allow them to make a stronger conclusion, doesn't that become a problem with the necessity test?
Well, Justice O'Neill, I don't know whether the information would allow their expert to make a stronger conclusion or whether it would actually refute his conclusions. If my expert hadn't studied it and come up with an opinion based upon it, then neither of it. It's likely wound the clock back 15 years and there is no 3D seismic data and they're doing it on 2D and well data and subsurface and the way geologists and geophysicists used to evaluate prospects. And it's our decision, and it's one that puts us in a dilemma, you know, which way are we better off? And it's our clear path now is that we believe this is a trade secret, we believe it is not relevant to any legitimate claim in this case, and we're insisting upon the protection of this trade secret. And I do want to use just a minute of my time left to address that because I think Justice Owen, have touched on the heart of it, and that is these Nofka Spinner Realties sprung out of a partition in 1954 when these plaintiffs' parents, their father and the two uncles, the first partition of the McGill Ranch, in which they partitioned surface and minerals, and that deed, the language is, it is expressly understood that if the above described land or any part of theirs hereafter under a lease, et cetera, then each of them reserves a third of an eighth non-participating royalty. So a third of an eighth, and then down the next generation, these three children of Scott McGill, one of these 54 partitioners, each got a third of his third of an eighth, so a third of an eighth of 72nd is 1.38. That's what they own. But this was the first generation partition of an old Texas ranch in which they were dividing it up among three brothers of cattle ranch. Oil operations were not in their mind at all. There is no basis whatsoever based on Danziger and other cases where there is a fixed and permanent non-participating royalty to apply any duty. All of the cases he cites involve cases like Mangus or other cases where the non-participating interest is either a term interest, which
well, let me just ask it this way. If it's questionable, if Danziger doesn't completely take care of this and the law is a bit unsettled in this area, then how can we say the trial court abused its discretion?
Justice O'Neill, with respect, I do not think it's unsettled.
Okay, so I guess, does your argument depend on us finding that it is not unsettled?
If we consider the Fifth Amendment, which he filed after the order, the first order was on September 7th. He files his motion, his Fifth Amendment.
Well, but there's nothing between the petitions being filed that makes the law more or less settled in this
no,
area.
But I'm saying the Fourth Amendment doesn't even allege a claim. I mean, he hasn't even pled a claim. So he doesn't even get to that. The Fifth Amendment, he does implicate the IRC in some of his pleadings on the fiduciary duty and other claims. But if you read it, there is no claim. If you read it and just look at some cursory law, it's a fanciful claim. And I think Danziger, if you look at Danziger, it looks like a lease. It was I transfer 7 acres.
Without getting into the merits of all the different claims, in order to rule your way on that question, we'd have to find that Danziger did take care of it and the law is not unsettled in this area. Else, it would be under the penumbra of the trial court's discretion.
I think I would agree. I'm not sure I understood all of that question, but if we consider it specifically, if either you consider the fourth to allege a claim or you look at the fifth, and so he has alleged a claim at that point, we're saying that in order for him to meet the first prong of the test, he's at least got to allege a claim that's recognized in law. And we say there is no duty to develop that Mr. Bass
and the law is settled on that.
Yes. Mr. Bass, as any owner of 100% of minerals on the surface, can choose to drill a well, lease for a well, or not at his election. He has utterly no duty to a fixed and permanent royalty.
And there's no claim for executive rights whatsoever.
No duty to develop.
No. Is there any claim that they own any executive rights?
No, none. They own zero minerals. On the IRC track, Mr. Bass owns 100% of the mineral estate subject to only to these.
I thought I saw somewhere that they were claiming an executive right.
That's over on the weekly track.
On the weekly track.
Only on the weekly. That's what this lawsuit is really about, is interpretation of the weekly. We think they're using this as a Trojan horse to get their hands on the seismic data on the IRC, which is going to lead to the third lawsuit. But anyway, so we do say it's important. Before someone can discover multi-million-dollar trade secrets, they have at least got a clear claim of them. If not, then the door's open to discover it anyway. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. We'll take a brief recess.